Psalm 78, I'll begin reading in verse 1. Just follow along as I read down to verse number 7. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord, and his strength, and his wonderful works that he hath done. Let me just stop for a moment. I do not think that Israel of old and America of today are the same. Okay, I'm not trying to make America Israel. Israel was a very unique nation. They were a theocracy. At least at one time they were. God himself was their king. God ruled over them through the judges and then supposedly vicariously through the kings. And they honored the Lord. They had a unique national relationship with the Lord. But I think we can look at that and get some applications and say, well, I think God would bless America if we would follow certain principles that we learned from the nation of Israel. One of the things about the nation of Israel is this, their religion and their history is very tied together. And I think as you look at the history of America, you understand America, I'm not saying everyone, I'm not saying all the pilgrims were Christians, I'm not saying all the Puritans were Christian, I'm not saying all of our forefathers are Christians, but we had a Christian heritage and a Christian thoughts about things and a Christian ideas and Christian morals. And then one of the reasons God blessed our nation was because it was based on those type of Christian principles. And this is what we're having in seeing here in Psalm 78. He's talking about how the nation was established upon the things of God. Verse number 5. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born. In other words, keep teaching this. Don't let it be lost. Let people know what the Lord has done. Understand how God has been good to us. Who should arise and declare them to their children. So we're teaching, we've learned it from our fathers. Now we're teaching to our children and trying to get our children to teach it to their children. Generational teaching here. Verse 7. That they might set their hope in God. That's the whole reason, because we're trying to get our attention focused on the Lord. And not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. Now, I think the Lord was uniquely involved in the founding of America. Not in the same way as he founded Israel, but I think there's some unique... If you look at our country and look at our founding and look at who was before us, I think you'll see some very unique things that the Lord did. Even back, if you go back to the days of the pilgrims and the Mayflower. Now here's, let me just start this way. Okay, I said all that. Now I know I'm going to give you a whiplash because I'm going to go a totally different direction here for a moment. Again, ready? I am a firm believer that a child's education is a responsibility of the parent, not the state. It's not the federal government's responsibility to educate your kids. It's not the state of Ohio's responsibility. It's not the county of Lorain. It's not even your local school board. Now, that's what they feel like. That's what they'll tell you. That's what they'll say, is that they have some type of responsibility. But ultimately, the responsibility of children are up to the moms and dads. One of the problems is moms and dads aren't doing it. And the state steps in, and we get mad at the state, but the truth is the parents aren't doing it, and so the state inserts themselves. Now, one of the issues I have with... let me just say it this way. I've worked at Christian schools for 11 years. Sometimes being the principal and the teacher, sometimes just being a teacher. Now, I don't think that when I talk about a child's education, the responsibility of the parent, I don't think that every child has to go to a Christian school. I think you can homeschool them. I think there's different avenues. I think the idea is this. If you take your kid and drop them off at the school, I don't care if it's public, private, Christian, and you say, take care of my kids, educate them, and you walk away, you have not fulfilled your responsibility. Your responsibility is to make sure that child is educated. Now, I think you can put them in a private school, a Christian school, but I think you ought to be involved in it. I think you ought to know what's going on, and take some responsibility. Some find it more helpful to homeschool. We've done both with our kids. Sometimes they've been in a Christian school. Sometimes they've been homeschooled. And I think the idea is that we as parents are taking responsibility. Now, sometimes people have asked me, well, why did you never send your kids to a public school? I have twofold reason for it. Number one, as a whole, and I understand this is a broad brush, but as a whole, public schools tend to have an anti-God bias. They do. They're anti-God. They have their curriculum, the way the teachers were taught, the schools are from. It's an anti-God bias. Now, some people say, well, they have to be because there's separation of church and state. But what they're trying to push is separation of people and God. It's not simply they don't want some church coming in and telling them how to teach in their school. They want people to be totally separated from God as if there's no accountability to God. Now, when that happens, then you create a morality based on man and not based on God. That's humanism. And we have humanism throughout our society. That man becomes the decider of what's right and wrong. That's why we can have abortion. You know why we have abortion? Because if a woman chooses to take that baby and abort it, then it's okay because it's her choice. It's her right. It's her freedom. But let me ask you this. But what's the right thing to do? It's still murder. You can say she has the freedom, the right. No matter how you describe it, that ultimately you go to the Word of God and it's taking a human life and it's a wrong thing. And so morality, when it's based on man, becomes humanism. Can you turn me down just a little bit? I don't know if I'm hurting your ears, but I'm hurting my ears. And so that becomes a humanistic way of life. Now, you go all the way back to the Garden of Eden, and you find out that was Satan's plan. What did he say to Eve? Take this fruit and eat it, and you'll be wise, and you'll be as gods, knowing good and evil. You can know all the way from the one extreme of good all the way to the other extreme of evil and everything in between. You can make all these decisions for yourself. You don't need God anymore, and it's a humanistic lie that Satan tells. So, schools have a anti-God bias. Now, I know you're trying to figure out where is this going with the pilgrims. Just stay with me. Schools are the breeding ground for change. It can be good or bad, but they are the breeding ground for change. Most of the change that comes into a society happens through the school system. Did you know that? If you go to the mainline denominations, and we'll just throw out a couple, let's say like Methodists, that'd be kind of mainline denomination, wouldn't you think? How about Presbyterians? This evening, if I said, Methodist churches, are they on fire and soul winning? Are they building churches? Are they trying to win people to the Lord and see revival? What would you say? No, don't know of any of that way. How about Presbyterians? Nope, they're kind of like Catholic light a lot of times they seem to be. But you go back into the 1800s, the Methodists and the Presbyterians were on fire. In fact, they probably in many ways during those years put Baptists to shame. Some of the great fundamentalists of the 1800s were Presbyterians. I mean, they didn't. I'm not saying they believed all that we believe. We'd have some doctrinal differences with them, but they were on fire about living for the Lord and living holy and winning souls. There's some great books written in the 1800s on soul winning by Presbyterians. The Methodists are the ones who took the gospel and came west. West would be Ohio and Kentucky and Illinois and Indiana. They had the great camp meetings. They helped bring about the second and to some extent the third great revival, great awakening. They are great guns, but what happened? Let me tell you what happened. Their schools. The man in the pulpit loved the Lord, believed the Bible, was after souls, but the teacher in the college was not, and the ones he taught. He taught them a criticism of the Lord, a criticism of the Word of God, taught them Calvinism, taught them all these false things, and eventually, as these guys took over the pulpits, the whole churches went down the drain. Schools breed change. Same thing is true in our own country. We have created generation after generation of people who are further and further away from God as a product of the school system. So, number one, they have an anti-God bias. Number two is this, which gets us now where we're going. More so. Here's the second big reason. They change their academics to support their bias. Since they already have a bias that's anti-God, they begin changing then their curriculum and their academics to support an anti-God bias. They will either teach their conclusion as facts, for example, evolution. Evolution is their conclusion. It's not the facts. There's no facts are that there were dinosaurs. Facts are there was a great, some cataclysmic event that covered the earth. There are certain facts that you can either fit into evolution if you kind of shove them hard enough and twist them and pound them in there. Or there are some of the same facts kind of fit very easily into the creation story. The conclusion of evolution is not a fact. It's what they've concluded to be true. So what they do is they teach their conclusion as if it was a fact. Or they do this. Now watch this, because now we're getting real close to where we're going. Or they leave out facts to support their conclusion. In other words, don't teach a lie, just don't teach the things that don't support what you want them to believe. And that's what we see in things like when you think about the Pilgrims and the first Thanksgiving and the history of our nation. History is defined, probably the best way it's defined is this, his story. The true teaching of history is God working in the lives of people, sometimes his people, sometimes lost people, but working in the lives of people to accomplish his will. And so, as a teacher, you can teach only certain facts of history and convince people that there is no God, that God was never involved. But if you were to stop and tell people, let me tell you really all the facts, let me tell you all that God has done, you would see that God blessed America. It wasn't just a bunch of fanatical people in our beginning who had some weird ideas, religious ideas, who pushed it upon our nation. It was people who saw the hand of God, who saw what God had done, who had many years, several generations of experience of what God had done, and they understood, just like Psalm 78 said, we've heard this, we believe this, we have taught this, and it carried on from generation to generation until you had schools who started not teaching it and changing what people believed. Now, there are many today who have never been taught because of the school system, because of other situations. There are many today who have never been taught the true facts about the Pilgrims and the first Thanksgiving. And now, I'm going to give you, I think, 12 different things, and these may be old hat to you, and you say, well, preacher, I already know all this. And I guess I'm sorry for wasting your time, but let me tell you, what I'm going to share with you here in the next few minutes, most of the people you know have never heard these things. Here's what they know about Thanksgiving. Some folks came over, kicked the Indians out, made a couple pumpkin pies, roasted a couple turkeys, and had at it. That's about all they know about Thanksgiving. They don't know why they came over, don't know who they were, don't know why they were here. They just know that they came over and didn't have anything else to do, so they had a Thanksgiving feast. Now, in fact, it's interesting, as I was just checking my facts and looking up some things, I came across one website, and the whole website was talking about Thanksgiving, the beginning of Thanksgiving, and everything was slanted about how wicked these Europeans were. How dare they come over to this pristine nation where all of these Native Americans who loved each other and they never fought each other, and how they were living in perfect paradise and at peace, and the mean old Europeans came over and started all the problems. You want me to tell you? That has nothing to do with history. But some people believe that. Some people believe that Europeans coming over caused the problems. They don't tell you that Indians were killing Indians a long time before white man ever showed up. Okay, they weren't peace-loving. It wasn't a pristine group of peace-loving people. Now, I think this. I think every Christian in America needs to know the true facts and then, and consequently, some Bible lessons so that, number one, we can learn from them. And number two is that we can share them with others. I want my kids to know, I want my grandkids to know, I want other people to know. We ought to know what really are the true facts, and how can we say, well, the Lord was in this. Look what the Lord has done. Now, to teach everything, I mean, I don't want to do a whole semester of history. I don't think you'd appreciate that. So I'd be a little concise with some of my facts, and I can't necessarily expand upon them, and so I got to kind of condense some of them just for the sake of time. But nothing that we're going to tell you that's going to be inaccurate, just some things we'll have to condense and not share every single year of everything. I don't think you'd appreciate that. I want you to stay with me. 12 things I want to share with you about Thanksgiving, about the first Thanksgiving, the Pilgrims, and then three conclusions from the Bible I think we can draw from it. Ready? You with me? Okay, here we go. Number one is this. Now, if you know anything about Thanksgiving, it began in 1620, so that's why we're starting in 1534. In 1534, King Henry VIII, anyone hear that guy? He's a guy, big fat guy, had a whole bunch of wives. King Henry VIII broke away from the Roman Catholic Church and started the Church of England. Let me tell you, that's where the first Thanksgiving really had its root. King Henry VIII was a good, faithful Catholic king until he wanted to divorce his wife and marry another, and the Pope said, no, you can't do that. He said, then I need my own church then. England being an island there, he kicked the Catholics out, And he basically took his own people and said, now instead of the Roman Catholic Church, now we have a church called the Church of England. And he took his own people and put them in place. They weren't necessarily trained to do that. He just, whoever would follow him and listen to him, he became, as king, he became head of the church. And then he ended up divorcing his wife, married that wife, and I think, in fact, got killed her, actually, and then married another one. And he was just a wicked man, but he set himself up as the head of the Church of England, put his own people in charge of those things, and much of what the Catholics taught that was unbiblical continued on. He didn't have a problem. Let me slow down. He had no problem with Catholic teaching. He just wanted to divorce one wife and marry another. That's the only thing he wanted to do. If the Pope would have let him, he'd have stayed a Catholic. Pope said no. He said, I have my own church, and that's what he started. And then he, because of being the king and the head of the church, he made a law. Said this, you must attend the Church of England. If you don't attend the Church of England, you pay a fine. You go out and preach somewhere else, and I haven't given you permission, you're not preaching what I'm telling you to preach, you go to jail. You know any guy who did that? Back in the 1500s, not current leaders, not talking about them yet. How about a guy named John Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress? He said, no, I'm not taking orders from the king. I'm taking orders from the king, but I'm not taking orders from that king. And he said, well, you will. You'll go to jail. And he went to jail because obviously we wouldn't agree with that. And so King Henry VIII took over the churches in the Roman Catholic churches in England, started his own church. Well, what happened then? Well, we move just a little further in history, and we find this. By 1600, two groups emerged. Both of them had issues with the Church of England, to some extent. One, we would call the Puritans. Anyone ever heard of the Puritans before? Okay? Now, let me just stop here and caution you. There are some, even some people who call themselves Baptists, who push Puritan teaching. Bad news. Puritans were good, I think, godly people. Their doctrine had major issues. Very Calvinistic. They had some bad doctrine. And so, that's the first group. The first group were the Puritans. And what they wanted to do was purify the church. They didn't really have a whole lot of issues. They just simply said, there's some things we don't like. We're not going to leave the Church of England. We just want to fix it. We want to stay in the Church of England and purify it or fix it. That's why they're known as Puritans. They're going to purify that church. When I say the church, I'm talking about the Church of England. But can I tell you this? The Bible says, come out from among them, be ye separate. And some of these people said, that's exactly what we need to do. This Church of England it was bad from the beginning. It is the wicked, heretical Roman Catholic Church with a different name tag. That's all it is. And they said, we got to come out from this. We can't be a part of this. And so they're going to separate out of it, and they were called separatists. They wanted to separate from the church. So here's what they did. Let's see if you think this is what they did. Here's what they did. They said, we're leaving this church. We're going to go down the road here. We're going to rent a storefront. We'll get a group of people, and we'll start our own church. You think that's what they did? What would stop them? The king. See, sometimes we think, well, wasn't England always this, like this free country? No, it was not. And so the king said, no, you're not. You will be part of the Church of England, or you will be fined, you'll be in jail, or even killed for it. Now, these separatists, because of their thinking, they were more tolerant, and this is important later in history. They're very more tolerant to others because they had issues with the Church of England, so they were tolerant to other people, other religions. And so they had, to some extent, okay, I'm going to be careful because I don't want to mislead you. To some extent, they had Baptistic teaching. I'm not saying they're Baptists, but they were much closer to Baptists than the Puritans. And so the Separatists had some Baptistic teaching, some things we would agree on. We'd have some issues about some other doctrine. Now, their problem was this. They did not want to be part of the Church of England, and many of them were separating, and they were going into houses and going to places, and they kept getting caught and kept being thrown in jail, kept being fined, and they just were having nothing. They could not teach what they believed the Bible taught. They could not do church the way they thought church should be. They were having to be forced into a church that they did not agree with. And they said, the only way we can do this is by leaving England. That seems like an easy decision. That's a hard decision, to leave your nation. And It wasn't like it is today. I mean, you just couldn't just, you know, go to some other country and just pick up shop there. I mean, it was a big thing to go from one country to another. And so what happened is the separatists came under oppression in England, and many left to find religious freedom. But it didn't go too well. They had several issues. One of the groups of separatists went to Holland, Netherlands. But they had some issues going on. Big part was cultural differences. I don't mean simply they spoke another language, but their kids were getting involved into the Dutch society, and the Dutch society they didn't feel like was a good influence on them. So they're trying to pull their kids out of the Dutch society, which created issues with the Dutch people. Like, you coming over here, now you got issues with us, go back home, you don't like us. And so they had cultural differences, they had economic problems because, you know, they spoke English, and it became a very conflicted situation. So now they're between a rock and a hard place. They're leaving England because they can't worship the Lord in England. They go to Holland, but then they can't kind of live in Holland. They're like, okay, spiritually we're going to die in England. Physically we're going to die in Holland. So we need another option. Guess what that option was? America. So what they did is they wanted to live for God and still be Englishmen. That's really what they wanted. They wanted to live for God the way they felt, their conscience dictated, and still be Englishmen. Because they... just like we would be, you know, we have strong ties and strong thoughts about our American heritage. We may have issues with our leaders, but for the most part, we're not saying let's all move to another country. I'm not saying that. Maybe get those people to move to another country. We stay here. Okay? Ready? Now, this brings us up to what we know about the Pilgrims. In 1620, what we're more familiar with. In 1620... after some bargaining and some going back and forth, some trying to figure out how they could do this. In 1620, they received permission to settle on land north of the Virginia colony in Jamestown. Now, what's important about this, here's what's important. If you know anything about Jamestown, that was 1607. 1607? I think so. 1608? Somewhere in there. Anyways, in Jamestown, Jamestown is in a Virginia colony, which is in the state of Virginia. Anyone ever been to Virginia? Out by the sea? Pretty nice out there, isn't it? I mean, they have some different climates, but you wouldn't expect Arctic wind down in Jamestown, would you? So now they're going to go a little bit north of Jamestown. Probably, our best understanding is they're going to go about where New York City is. That's a little bit north, but they still don't, they're still thinking it's probably, you know, it's Virginia colony, it's got to be Virginia weather. So that's what they're thinking. They're not thinking, where they ended up is not where they planned. That's probably one of the most things you have to understand. Where they end up is not where they were planning to end up. But I think it was the hand of God. Because God really used that in the forming of our nation. And so, they set sail on two boats. I don't know if you know that or not. Two boats. Problem was, the other boat, Speedwell, it didn't do too well, and they couldn't make the trip, and so they all had to stay. They weren't that far from, actually, they're working up the coast of England. They pulled over to a port. All the ones who they could, they got off the Speedwell and put on the Mayflower. Most of them got on the Mayflower. And they put, I think 30 people on the Mayflower, went up 130. They had 102, now it's 132 on there. So here's the makeup. They're getting ready now, finally, to leave England, head to America. 41 separatists. 61 strangers. Strangers are anyone who weren't the separatists. They're soldiers. They were people going there for their fortune. Together, the separatists and the strangers make up the Pilgrims. Okay, they're the whole group. Not really. It's 40-60, I guess. So 40% separatists, strong religious. 60% are the strangers. Now, that makeup, it was the separatists really became the heart and soul of the Pilgrim group. So much of what we think about the Pilgrims is because of that influence of those separatists in that group. So that's who leaves. That's an important number because we'll come back to it. 41, 61, and 30. 132 leave. Anyone, what do you think the voyage was like? Well, let me tell you the story. Miles Standish used to go up on the deck every day and put suntan lotion on. He had his deck chair. He had his little drink with a little umbrella. And they'd come by and they'd fill it up. And it was a really nice trip. I mean, you know, it was like they had, the captain was that bald-headed guy off the Love Boat. And, it was just a really, really nice time. Do you think so? No, not at all. It was a very hard, arduous, dangerous trip. Hard and dangerous. First half, not so bad. They got halfway, they hit storms. And storms the other half of the way. They thought, halfway through, when they started hitting the storms, they thought about turning back. The captain of that boat, of the Mayflower, had never sailed across the Atlantic before. So he's thinking, home sounds pretty good right now. And they said, no, let's go on. They had some trouble, and I think one of the masts broke or something. They had to do some work, and was able to get things going. They kept on trudging along. During that voyage, two of them died, one of the sailors, one of the voyage people. Passenger, that's the word I'm looking for. One of the sailors, one of the passengers died. The main cabin was made to sleep 30 people. They had 80 people jammed in it. Now, I want you to listen to this, because this is probably something some of you may have never known this. The ceiling was only about 5 feet tall. That was their cabin. Okay? 80 people crammed in that cabin, made for 30. They were wet, sick, dirty, and they had a big outbreak of fleas and lice. Most wore the same clothes during the entire voyage. 2 months. Never changed. That was the condition they were in. See, we think, man, they got over and then they had problems. It was problem from day one. I mean, they were trying, just trying to get away. One of the boats leaking, they all get jammed on the Mayflower. They go, okay, smooth sailing, a month in, halfway through, all of a sudden storms, the ship starts having problems, they're all jammed in there, they're throwing up, all this stuff's happening. Storms, as they hit them, remember, they're trying to go about New York, Hudson River. The storms keep pushing them north. They don't really know this. They don't really know, they don't have all the stuff we have. And so they end up where we know today is Cape Cod. They're driven north, much further north than they expect to be, which creates a problem. It's November. Imagine November right now in this weather, you just showed up on shore and you're expecting to be in Virginia. You're not prepared, are you? You're not prepared in the least. And so now they've hit the Cape Cod shore, not prepared. So what do? Well, they arrive in November 1620. Along the way, on that voyage, I mentioned all the cramped conditions. One of the women were pregnant when she got on the boat. It was only a 2 month trip, so she was about 7.5 months, maybe 8 months pregnant. And she had a baby on board. Cramped conditions, 80 people in a 30-person cabin. Here's this woman giving birth. It's filthy. Could you imagine wanting to give birth in a situation like that? She gives birth to a baby on the voyage over. I think the baby's name is a girl, Oceanus or something like that. It's a kind of a strange name. And then once they get there, another one is born soon after arriving. They're very unprepared for the winter. And so they get out. And they talk to Miles Standish and talk to William Bradford, and they go on. Fortunately, I don't know if you know this or not, it's probably a fact, one of the facts no one probably knows. Where they landed happened to be the first place where they built a Motel 6. Didn't know that, did you? And someone left the light on for them. And so they got off and they said, oh man, and they all found their individual rooms. Is that what you think happened? Okay, put yourself in their shoes. They get here. What's here waiting for them? Nothing. Yeah, snow. Cold. Boston Red Sox. I mean, there's nothing here waiting for them. So where do you think they spent the winter? On the ship. It's still cramped. It's still dirty. What do you think the life's going to be like? in the middle of the winter, what do you think life's going to be like? It's going to be not good. Which now gets more into what they bring, how they should encourage us as Americans and as Christians. They spent most of the winter living aboard the ship. They tried to get off a couple times. They built a big common house. The common house burned down. They ended up running back to the ship. The captain of the ship was going to leave until all the sailors started getting sick, and then he got stuck there as well, which is a good thing, because if the ship had left, then they would really have been in trouble. Sickness breaks out. Now, these next couple points, I want you to listen carefully. Sickness begins spreading among them. At some times, only 6 or 7 out of the whole group are well enough to take care of the rest. Remember, there's 132 people at one time. People started dying. They have no idea where they're at. They have no idea who the inhabitants are around them. And so they wait until nighttime, get their rowboat, put the dead people in the rowboat, row to shore, bury the dead in unmarked graves, and hurry back to the ship because they don't want the Indians to know how many people are dying on board. They're in fear of their life. They're cramped on shore. It's the middle of the winter. They're all sick. It's a filthy living conditions. This is what they're doing. By March of 16... Now remember, they come in November. Okay, December, January, February, March, 4 months. By March of 1621, half of them are dead. Half are dead. And we have people who say, well, preacher, I can't come to church because, you know, I can't find my shoe that matches this shoe. And here's these people who love Jesus enough. They said, we'll leave England and we'll go find religious freedom. Half of them are dead. By March of 1621, only 53 of those passengers, of those 102, the separatists and the strangers, 53 still alive, and half of the sailors have died. To make it so you understand what the significance is. Okay, now remember, they're going there to start a new life from scratch. So think about these numbers. Of the 26 men who left who had families, only 12 of them are now living. 14 families have lost their breadwinner. Now remember, they're starting a colony. 14 of them are dead. Of the single men, which are kind of replacements for the ones that are dying out there, of the 12 single men, only 4 of those are now alive. This is 4 months into it. Now, I want you to stop. I want you to think with me. It's March. Half are dead. The boat's going back to England. What are you going to do? What would you do? I know what you'd do. I'm going back to England. Well, I shouldn't say I know. Some would do that. You may not. Others would do that. They say, well, this ain't working. But they had a purpose and they had a reason. They said, nope. To me, going there was... something, staying there was something, but getting off that boat in March and saying, we're staying, and the boat sailing off. Could you imagine what that was like? I mean, they're already, half of them have already died. Now, fortunately, the weather turned, started getting a little bit better. Those who were sick healed up. It's not smooth sailing yet. The pilgrims are able to plant and then harvest crops by the fall. So they're thinking, they had some help from the Indians. It's really history. You know, it depends on who tells it. Some will say the Indians were like buddy-buddy with them. Some will say the Indians were standoffish. We really don't know historically. We know they had some input. At least two of them spoke English for different reasons, but how much they helped, we're not really sure. But they had some help from the Indians. After the harvest, and now this gets us to Thanksgiving, but I'm going to add some more details because you notice we're only number 8 here. After harvest, they had a 3-day Thanksgiving feast. They're just thankful they're alive. Here's the kind of food they had. They had deer, because the Indians brought deer. I think they brought 5 deer, dead deer, and ate them. Okay, they had fowl. We really don't know if they had turkey or not. We know they had bird. Could have been duck, could have been geese, could have been turkey. We don't know. Just the record says they brought fowl. Okay, they had seafood, lobster, clam, stuff like that. And then they had vegetables, corn, probably Flint corn, peas, squash, and pumpkin. And then he had fruits and nuts. Let me tell you what they didn't have. They didn't have mashed potatoes and gravy. Because potatoes we have, they didn't have them yet. They didn't have sweet potatoes. They hadn't grown them yet. That was unfamiliar to them. You know what else they didn't have? They didn't have pumpkin pie. They didn't have sugar and stuff like we had. They didn't have cranberry sauce. So a lot of the stuff we have on Thanksgiving, we think, boy, us and the pilgrims. The pilgrims are like, who? Us? We didn't have that stuff. But they did have what they had, and they enjoyed it. And they were eating, and they were just thankful for their survival. So you're thinking, whew, now it's all falling together. Not quite yet. Ready? In November of 1621, a year after they've arrived, 35 more show up. Woo! 35 more! But guess what they didn't bring? Supplies. 35 people came knocking on the door saying, hey, we're moving in with you. Well, what you got with you? I got my wife and my kids. No food. And all of a sudden, they're right back where they started. More people than they got food. And now they're struggling again. In fact, we're told by history, the very first 3 years they struggled, and it was touch and go for the first 3 years, whether or not, because we think once they had the Thanksgiving, everything from then on went phew, but they spent 3 years struggling. It wasn't even sure they were going to make it until about 3 years. Now, a couple of things I want to point out, because the next three we're going to go real fast and get to the Bible lessons. Here's one of the issues they had. Originally, they had this idea. You work your garden, you work your garden, you work your garden, you work your garden, I'll work my garden, you work your garden, and we'll all bring our crops together and put them in the big barn, and whatever you need, you go get, whatever you need, you go get, whatever you need, you go get, and whatever I need, I go get, whatever you need. Sounds good, doesn't it? What happens is this. Some guy says, you mean I can go in there and get what I need? Then why do I need to work my garden? And all of a sudden, you're working your garden, you're working your garden, and we're all goofing around. Democrats, yeah. And now, not only they added people to it, but they added loafers. Because some people came, the separatists to start with, they wanted religious freedom, but not all were separatists. Some of them just came there for economic reasons and other reasons, and they would go out and they would scout around, they'd look for gold, and they would do no work until harvest time came, and then, now, hey, I'll help you harvest your garden. Because I want your stuff in the barn. And then when came time to eat, my word's spinning out there, came time to eat, everyone else is diving into it, and now again, they're running out of food. Still a struggle. So those 3 years were a very struggling time for these pilgrims. Now, there's a reason I'm pointing that out. Number 10, the first 3 years are very difficult. That's why I said. Number 10 is this. Here's what they did. In 1623, they got this idea. Each colonist was given 1 acre. And here's what they said. You have 1 acre, whatever you grow, you eat. You have 1 acre, whatever you grow, you eat. You have 1 acre, whatever you... Guess what people started doing? They started working. Not everyone. Within 12 months, the ones who weren't working, they kind of disappeared somehow. But the other ones, you know, they started working. And they said, well, we better start getting busy here. So more colonists arrived over the next few years. By 1640, 20 years later, there are 7 towns. Now things are really going well. And here's the last thing. 1691, they're annexed by the larger Massachusetts Bay Colony, and Plymouth ceases to exist like it was. So that's the story of the pilgrims, what they went through, and I did condense a lot. But here's what we can learn from it. Ready? Give you 3 things that we can learn from that. That we can say, okay, here's what the Lord has done. I can understand this, and here's some things I can teach others. Number 1 is this. Living for Jesus has always required hard work. We convince ourselves in 2013, boy, back in the 50s, everyone loved Jesus. Everyone went to church. It was easy to live for Jesus in the 50s. No, it wasn't. Let me tell you something. Every generation's had to struggle to live for Jesus. But God's grace has always been sufficient. It always is possible. Let me show you a verse here. Mark chapter 8. We'll come back to Psalms here in a second. But Mark chapter 8. Here's what the Lord told his disciples. Look at verse 34. And when he had called the people unto him with his disciples also, he said unto them, whosoever will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Now, the motivating factor for the separatists, why they did all this, was their desire to live for Jesus free of government control. And it meant they had to bear a cross. And so cross-bearing has always been required. We're looking at our nation today and we're saying, boy, if things continue the way they are, preacher, we're going to lose our religious freedoms. We may not even be allowed to meet together. That may be a possibility. Can I tell you, that's not a new thing, though. We have... Okay, I want to be careful. I don't want to get cynical or sarcastic, so I'm going to be careful how I say this. To some extent, we've gotten lazy as Christians in America because it's been easy. It's not easy in other places in the world. Other places in the world, people who love Jesus just like you do, who believe just like you, they literally are putting their life on the line to come out to a Bible study. They're putting their life on the line. They don't go door to door because... You know, they would get caught easy. So they have to be real sneaky how they try to get the gospel to people and how to try to witness to people. But we've been spoiled. We live in a free nation. It's been, to some extent, easy for us, maybe than some other Christians. And we say, well, preacher, what's going to happen? Okay, here's what we think. Jesus must be coming soon because of, look at America. Can I tell you, America is not the end all. It may be the Lord might not come for another 200 years. And maybe the Lord come in 200 minutes or 200 seconds. I don't know when he's coming, but I'm saying this, that we have no right to think that we should be at ease for our entire life and never have a struggle. There is the idea that we bear the cross, that we go through some suffering, that we live for the Lord and even sometimes die, or not die, but maybe struggle as we try to live for the Lord. I think one of the things that is said is when we remove really what the pilgrims went through and some of our forefathers went through, that we forget that it's always been a struggle to live for Jesus, to make decisions and go forward. We have this idea, well, preacher, the Lord wouldn't want me to do this because I would lose my job. The Lord wouldn't want me to do this because I'd lose some friend. The Lord wouldn't want me to do this because that would be a sacrifice. Can I tell you, that's probably exactly what he wants you to do. He wants you to bear the cross. He doesn't expect you to say, well, if it's hard, I'm not going to do it. Well, if it's difficult, he's saying, no, you do right. If you get on a boat and have to go halfway and the ship almost sinks and people are dying and you go into hard things, but that's the right thing to do. It honors the Lord. So living for Jesus has always required hard work. Second great lesson we can learn from the pilgrims. And as we look at the Word of God, we look at some of our history. Go with me to Proverbs 25. Proverbs 25. Now this is a lesson I think that our nation has ignored, and it's coming back to hurt us. Proverbs 25, look at verse 28. Let me read the verse, I'll show you the lesson. 25:28 of Proverbs, he that hath no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down without walls. That probably doesn't mean as much to us as in Bible days, but the city was kind of its own, many times its own protection. And so the walls protected that city from enemies coming in. So the walls had to be there. If they had no walls, people would just walk in and just take what they want, kill people. And so they said, if you have no walls, you're without protection. You're at the whim of all the other things in life. And he's saying, that's what happens when you have no control of your spirit. No self-control. You won't make yourself do right. You're just like a cork in the water. Just wherever the water takes you, that's where you go. He's saying that is the idea that you have no self-control. So number two is this: self-government is required for long-term success. If you're going to succeed for the Lord or succeed in life, you have to have some oomph to yourself. Now let me tell you why we learned this from the pilgrims. Some of you may, have anyone heard of Mayflower Compact? First compact car built? No. Mayflower Compact. It is a written document. Let me tell you why they came up with it. Let me tell you what happened on board of the Mayflower. When they realized, they looked out and they said, land ho! And they looked out and they said, that ain't Virginia. So they tried to go south, but the wind was so bad, the storms were so bad, that they said, man, this ship's not going to make it. So they put their ship, came around Cape Cod, went to the harbor, anchored their ship, put some guys on a longboat, said, okay, let's go and see if we can figure out where we're at. And as they're trying to figure out where they're at, they realize they're not where they're supposed to be. So they come back. Actually, a few died on that trip as well, froze because they were wet in that little boat, and they went on shore to sleep, and some of them never made it back to the ship. Now, when they came back and they realized they weren't where they're supposed to be, the light bulb came on. You see, back then, when you left England to come over to a new world, you basically did on behalf of the government and behalf of some type of enterprise, some type of association. They were funding you, okay? And so you had a charter, or it's also called a patent, and that said you lived here, you did this, you earned certain money, and you sent it back to England, and that paid for you going there and paid for the land, and you had these laws, and here's what you did. But they weren't there. And they said, we don't have to follow anyone's laws. I don't care what that document says. I don't care what it says. I'm not there. Those don't apply. We can do what we want. And all of a sudden, the spiritual people, the smart people said, ha, 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 it ain't going to work. We open the door and everyone goes on shore and everyone does what they want. We're in big trouble. And so they sat down, they wrote out the Mayflower Compact and said, these are the laws we'll live by. Here's how we're going to be governed. And it became actually an important document in our history because we said, we will not live in anarchy. We'll live by government. Now, I point that out for this reason. Sometimes people of our ilk and stripe, we almost come across like we are anti-government. Government is something the Lord has established. Okay. We may have issues with people who are leading the government and what the government is doing, but government itself is a good thing. And self-government is even a better thing. Now, before they left the ship, they wrote up the Mayflower Compact, set up the rules. Now, even though the colony was self-governed at that time, some of the men were. And that's what we see in our nation today. We may have some government in our country, but some of the people aren't governing themselves. And that's where the problem comes in. And so that's when they finally, took them about 3 years, and they finally said, here's how we're going to govern ourselves. What you grow, you eat. What you grow, you eat. What you grow, you eat. If you don't grow, you don't eat. And they said, well, surely they're not going to let us starve. Surely we're not going to go without. And guess what happened? They went out and they starved. Next winter came, all those people were gone. Everyone said, we're going to work this time. I mean, next spring, they said, we're going to work now. And so, once each was required to provide their own, the shortage soon came to an end. So we see this idea that what the Bible teaches. We've got to have some self-restraint, some self-control. We've got to have some self-motivation. Those are good things to have. Here's the third great Bible lesson we see from the Pilgrims. One generation can have a lasting impact on future generations. Well, how do we know that? Because tomorrow we celebrate what someone did almost 400 years ago. We still celebrate it. We're still thoughtful of it. It was such a profound thing. And most of us don't even know all they went through because there's really not a whole lot said about what they went through. What I told you, we're not even, there's only two accounts. I forget the first guy's name. He only wrote, I think, one or two lines in his book or his diary. And then William Bradford wrote a book and told some things. We don't even know a whole lot about it. But it was such an impact that even today we still talk about this idea of our Pilgrim fathers and what they went through. And we recognize their sacrifice and their labor. Psalms 145 says this in verse 3. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall praise thy works to another and shall declare thy mighty acts. I will speak of the glorious honor of thy majesty and of thy wondrous works. That's the idea that's what we're going to talk about, what the Lord has done, how the Lord has came through and how the Lord took care of him, how the Lord provided, and how these people stuck by it. So here's what we understand. That our nation was shaped by those who came and why they came. Now, as you know, you only got one more thing to write. But I'm going to stop for a moment. And let me explain something to you. You ever know anything? You know anything about South America? Is it anything like North America? You say, well, that's because they're a different race. It has nothing to do with race. Let me tell you what the difference between North and South America is, primarily. South America had two major influences. Roman Catholic Church, Europeans who came for money. The Europeans who came to South America came primarily for money, for gold. And the Roman Catholic Church came in and brought people into bondage. The two big influences in North America is a Protestant type of church. There were Baptists, but primarily Protestant. Protestant type of churches, which preached the gospel. And number two, people came for religious freedom. That's the difference in North and South America. We're shaped because of those who came, who established a certain mindset, a certain philosophy of life, a certain way of living, and it's come down to our 400 years later, we're still influenced, we're still affected by these things. Now, listen carefully and I'm done. Knowing these facts should cause us to realize how blessed we are as a nation, our ancestors, but also, here's the last statement coming up, it should also cause us to realize that God was at work from the very beginning to establish a nation where we could be free to obey God. As our nation, now listen, as our nation ceases to obey God, we will cease to have those freedoms. We can vote any way you want to vote. We will not turn our back on God and continue to have the freedoms that God gave us. You say, well, we'll pass this law. The only thing that we'll do is we'll be more oppressive in every law. We'll have another Patriot Act to guarantee our freedoms as they take them away. That gives us one last statement. An immoral nation will not remain free. We began as a nation because people love freedom and they love Jesus. When we lose that love for Jesus, we're going to lose that love for freedom. That's probably maybe the greatest lesson we learned from the pilgrims. They came because of their love and desire to live for the Lord freely. As that desire leaves us, so does those freedoms. All right. Appreciate your attention. Let's pray.